Coming up on this week's A Lively Experiment, new developments in the aftermath of the disastrous trip by two state employees doing business in Philadelphia last year. And should students put their cell phones away during school hours? One district says a resounding yes.
A Lively Experiment is generously underwritten by...
Hi, I'm John Hazen-White, Jr. For over 30 years, A Lively Experiment has provided insight and analysis of the political issues that face Rhode Islanders. I'm a proud supporter of this great program and Rhode Island PBS.
Joining us on the panel, attorney and former state representative Mike Marcello, Boston Globe reporter and Rhode Island PBS Weekly contributor Steph Machado, and attorney and former House Minority Whip Nick Gorham. Welcome into Lively. I'm Jim Hummel. It is great to have you with us this week. We talked about it a lot last year, the so-called Philadelphia fiasco, a trip by two high-level state employees seeking a contract to refurbish the Cranston Street Armory that left a trail of embarrassment and a resignation. Now David Patton, who claimed he was having a health issue at the time, has agreed to pay a $5,000 fine for a free lunch he took and more. The Ethics Commission's executive director said it had no ability to impose penalties for inappropriate behavior. So, Nick, it's hard to believe it's been a year. We talked about it a lot last year. Probably appropriate, but, you know, there was so much more to this story that you wish you could hold people accountable for.
Yeah, I wish you could drill down into what really happened, because it must be very interesting. But it's two guys let loose in Philadelphia who made fools of themselves and made our state look bad. And, you know, their transgressions under the ethics laws, I think, are merely incidental to the trip. The trip was a disaster. And that's the really sad thing. They were trying to, work with a contractor to make some really good improvements in the Cranston Street Armory. And what a mess.
Yeah, and the Ethics Commission said, you know, their authority doesn't allow them to punish these former state officials for the sexist, racist remarks. So it was really narrow to the free lunch part of the trip. But there was obviously a lot more that went on that trip that was problematic.
And although David Patton resigned, so, I mean, he lost a $175,000 job. I'm not sure where he is now.
Yes.
So ultimately, but Jim Thorson, who was the other guy there, he's challenging it. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, he's basically saying that I didn't know my lunch was paid for, but yet they were sitting in a restaurant that had been closed, especially open for them. Somebody was paying for that. So it's a weird defense. I do think that it was very interesting that one of the commission members, I think it was Judge Ritchie, made a motion to increase the fine to $10,000, but he couldn't get a second from the Ethics Commission. So I think that tells you that there was probably a little bit more to this story than what we probably know. But it'll be interesting to see if they do ever release the investigation notes to their findings, because I think that would be shed some more light onto
it. Did they do that?
They could. I think they can.
I don't think I ever recall seeing that, where
you
would
either
go in, or whether they would say $5,000. I mean, you know, in the overall scheme of things, I think the largest we've ever seen, John Salona paid 30 years ago. I mean, sometimes you want to take a pound of flesh out of people, but you have to keep it within the confines of what the Ethics Commission has done over the years, right?
Right.
And I think the goal was a deterrent, right? To make sure that other officials aren't taking free things from state contractors and abusing this law.
Right. Just as a side note, I was going to talk about this later on, Mike, but when we talked about it last week, there are proposed changes to the Access to Public Records Act. You were around when they did the balancing test years ago.
That was my bill, yeah.
That was your bill 10 years ago. It really was the Access to Public Records and ultimately the Attorney General's siding that got this whole story out. We might not even be talking about it.
Yeah, I think the Attorney General's office needs to get some credit for actually, you know, demanding that these things get released. It was their findings that said that these emails would need to be released. One of the exceptions to the open records law is that official communications between government officials in an email capacity not necessarily have to be released under the current statute, and I think that needs to be changed, because that's how most people communicate
with elected officials.
And that's how most people communicate today.
But I find that odd, because elected officials, but if you're between department heads or whatever, just regular public officials, you could get at it.
Right. So if the email goes to the chief of staff, that's a public record. But if it goes to the governor, it's not. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
It's nice to have tension between the attorney general and the governor's office, because we learn more.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, Nerone has always been aggressive about forcing the executive branch, the governor's office, to disclose things. And, you know, I think it's been good for the public, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a healthy
little tension.
It's
is a healthy thing.
Tension. And there's a lot of criticism of the fact that the Attorney General has the authority to handle APRA appeals, because so many APRA appeals are about police departments, and the Attorney General's office works so closely with police departments, so perhaps they shouldn't be handling those appeals. But so far, we have seen a lot of cases where the Attorney General overturns APRA denials from the McKee administration.
But Peter Noronha's not totally, he hasn't just gone, he's unpredictable because he turned down the request to waive the fees.
Which we knew he was going
because
to do
under
because the law allows the fees.
And he's got to go by the law.
We tried anyway, but, and he did criticize, he did ask the McKee administration to waive the fees, but he cannot require them to do so because the way the law is written is you have to go to court to waive the fees. And of course the legal fees for the Globe to go to court waive the fees would be more than the fees.
Let me just ask you from a process. So you were there 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago, when they did the balancing test, which is so key. We had a reporters panel on last week, and I asked Ed Fitzpatrick, who's part of the New England First Amendment Coalition, are they asking too much this year? They're like 47 changes. Should you look at a couple? Was the balancing test part of
It was part of the larger, but that was the main focus of the bill, because we had decisions from the court that said any identifiable record to a personnel couldn't be released, and that was just completely outside of it. So we wanted to have that balancing test implemented, but that was the main moment. But we did have other reforms. I think the initial arrest report within 24 hours, that was part of that amendment as well. So but
that's huge. I use that every day.
But before you couldn't get that.
Right.
So that was one of the other.
So thank you, Representative Marcello.
You're welcome.
We appreciate that. Do you think they're biting
the
off more they can choose because the governor's, it's almost like a concerted effort. They've now lined up everybody and his brother saying, from the corrections to the Narragansett Bay Commission, I mean, everybody's saying, we don't like these changes in APRA. Not surprising.
I think it's because, they think it's going to create more work for them. I think the time frame has been shortened a little bit. I think the fees have been decreased. I think that we have to remember that this is not their government. This is the people's government. And that we have to get these records out. I mean, I think there needs to be some reform. They'll come to a compromise on it. They won't get everything they want, but they'll get some of it. And it's a good thing. It's been a decade since that law has been amended, and it needs to be looked at. Should it be looked at every 10 years, frankly?
Other representative, Mr. Webb?
Oh, I think they should expand APRA. I think it's been a great law, and, it's ironic, the agencies have their lobbyists up there lobbying against the disclosure of information, lobbying the General Assembly. It just seems absurd to me. This is a decision that General Assembly can make all on its own. They don't need to have lobbyists telling them why Narragansett Bay Commission or anybody else shouldn't have to disclose things. It's our government.
And look at Florida. They say, there's going to be legal issues. If the leadership bumped its head collectively and said, let's ask Steph Machado what she would want, one or two things out of those proposed dozens of changes, what would help you the most in your job?
Okay, I would say the two biggest things from a journalism perspective are making the emails of elected officials public and the waiving of the fees in the case when a request is in the public's interest.
Yeah.
The only thing that I would disagree with you on, I do believe that the current law states, and I think it's important, that it says emails between an elected official and people they represent, their constituents, should not be released. And I think that's fair, because as an elected official...
Yeah, if there's an exemption for constituent emails, I think that
And that's currently in the law now.
But right now it's all their emails, talking to their staff.
Right. I think that's important, because we, as former elected officials, we got some personal emails from people with, crises and issues and some personal stuff, and I don't think that should be made public.
No, but some of it would be very entertaining to read.
I do think we'd be careful with that exemption because, if your chief of staff is also your constituent, they'll have to be careful in their language.
Right.
But also you would think that the elected officials would know. I mean, if you're in office and these are going to be public, then maybe you use your Dan McKee at Gmail account.
Doesn't make a difference under the law.
They would have to go with he would have to produce his personal.
Yes.
Doesn't matter.
But I will say sometimes they don't ask them for their personal emails. Right.
So we sort of have to specifically request
if they used their personal email. I mean, we shouldn't have to ask for their personal email, but If they use their personal email for work business, then you need to release
it. I always advise my I represent two towns. I always advise the elected officials, do not use your personal email for official business.
And I know people that falsely think if they use their personal email or their personal cell phone, somehow that's not going to end up being released.
I would have been one of those people. Yeah. I had no idea. You learn something new every week on Lively. All right, to be continued, Steph had a great piece for The Globe and for Rhode Island PBS Weekly. It aired on Sunday about cell phone bans in one district, Central Falls. This is, you know, look, cell phones we know can be a distraction in our own lives. Central Falls tried beginning last fall to ban all cell phone use during the school day. Here's a little bit of her story.
If something looks off about this hallway full of teenagers in 2024, it's that not one of them is looking down at a phone. At Central Falls High School in Rhode Island's tiniest city in the urban core, an experiment has been underway since October 1st.
Life at this school changed forever on that day.
That's when the school fully banned cell phones and other personal electronics like headphones and smartwatches, requiring students lock the devices in these pouches from the company Yonder for the entire school day.
So I can't get in here.
Yeah, you can only open it with
a magnet.
The pouches unlock with these devices, held by staff and also mounted on walls at the end of the school day. Dr. Dolores Davis Grant, a longtime English and drama teacher, says this was necessary.
Cell phones were the scourge of this building. They were such a problem. You'd have students texting underneath the desk, asking to go to the bathroom, but really they're going to make phone calls, bosses calling them to tell them their work schedule, parents calling.
There were several problems, Principal Bob McCarthy says, that led school leaders to contemplate a new cell phone policy.
I think one is the distraction in terms of learning, and then also we found a lot of conflicts generated through kids texting or using social media.
Dr. Grant says she's seen a huge difference since the personal electronics went away.
The students in my classes all got higher grades. I feel like they were more communicative, looking me straight in the eye, talking with other students. I heard the chatter out in the hallways of students talking to each other, communicating in a lively manner. I really enjoyed that. That's one of the things that changed.
To watch the entire story by Steph, you can visit ripbs.org/weekly. You know, you watch this piece, Steph, and you think, why aren't more school districts doing this? Seems to work. I know not everybody's on board, but it seemed like it's working in Central Falls.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see if there's sort of measurable results, but even just the anecdotal results that she describes of students being more engaged in class is huge. You know, I think every district has its own needs. This district in particular, I mean, something that really struck me was how many people told me that the kids were getting distracted by their jobs that they have outside of school. And in this particular district, a lot of students have jobs on the weekend after school. They might actually be helping to support their families. And so to have your boss calling and saying, hey, can you pick up a shift? I'm trying to get you on the schedule, is really distracting from school. And so I think that's something that I hadn't thought of before reporting this story.
Well, my wife teaches in Providence, and she said, this, as did the folks on the show we just watched, it was a game changer. They started paying attention.
They do that? Do they do that?
They
at
do
her
that
school?
In Providence. Yeah, yeah. 360.
Okay.
And it's been very successful. I have one of the little pouches at home.
Did she make you put your cell phone
at the dinner table?
No, she's asked me to climb into it and just stay there.
Nick's wife says, I want your total attention. You can do this.
Yeah, I am curious if those do it for the rest of the Providence High Schools, because it's a little bit expensive to buy them for every single student.
Yeah, $27,000 for the district, right?
That's Central Falls. Providence, it would cost way more. Yeah.
All I can say is when I went to high school, we had one payphone in the stairwell, and we used to line up to use it. So things have changed. I know that Smithfield is looking at a policy. There was an article in the local Valley Breeze this week about it. As an adult, I find it distracting. You know, we're in court or in some, and the phone rings or you're trying to text, or it is distracting. So I can imagine when you're trying to teach someone something that it would be very distracting. But I think it's important that each school district, you know, fit their own little policy as to what their specific needs. I also think it's important that, you know, I think parents have a legitimate concern about having to reach their kids, especially with all this, you know, violence that have gone in schools. And I can see why a parent would want their student to have a cell phone at all times.
There were two things that struck me that if you watch Steph's larger piece, one of the students you interviewed who liked this, he said, not using my phone in school encourages me or inspires me to not use it as much out of school.
Right.
I thought that was really interesting.
It almost broke that habit. And that particular student, he was a freshman during the pandemic. So his whole high school life started virtually. And so now he's back in person, but he still had that habit of always being on his phone. And now that he puts it away, he realized that he likes it. And outside of school, in his social life or just in his regular life, he puts the phone away too because he likes just the face-to-face interactions. I thought that was really interesting.
The flip side is you interviewed the people in Lincoln, mm-hmm. and they said, look, you got to live in the real world. So we can kind of, you know, put the kids in a bubble here, but we feel it's important to teach them. It's your responsibility. We have rules. You can't use it, but we're not going to put it in a pouch. And if you violate the rules, then there are consequences.
Right, exactly. They decided to just start letting them use the phones outside of class. So that's, you know, in the hallway, between classes, and in the lunchroom. I think they were, frankly, sick of going up to kids all through the lunch period saying, put your phone away, put your phone away, put your phone away. And they said, you know what? They're on break between classes. They can use the phones. But if they use them during class, we're going to enforce that. And so they said it's working for them.
I think one of the reasons they went with the pouches is that the policing of the phones, that in itself was a major time-consuming project for every teacher in the short time they had to teach. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the pouch just was so absolute, and it immediately diverted all attention to the teaching.
Right. You know, it's so funny. We, our kids just missed the tablet thing. They didn't get phones. You know, our kids thought, they made it sound like they were lepers. Oh, we're the only kids in our class who don't have cell phones. We waited till they were seventh or eighth grade.
Yeah.
And I remember my daughter, of course, talking to my wife and saying, when did you get your first cell phone? And my wife said, I was 33 years old. They don't think.
There's a movement, wait until eighth, where a lot of parents are trying to band together to wait until eighth grade to give their kids a smartphone.
But you got to get everybody on board, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can give them a phone that's not a smartphone if you want to be able to reach them, you know, just who's picking you up after school, that thing. But smartphones, a lot of parents are trying to say, we got to delay this.
Mm. Mike, you were on a school committee.
No.
No,
town council.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you ran for school.
I did run. For
that's
this.
Right. I'm sorry.
I tried. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Fell a little short.
Wow.
Good work, Jim.
I ran for speaker once too. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. I heard Mike Marcello's going to be speaker. Then it was Nick Mattiello the next day. But we won't go down that. We won't go down that rabbit hole. I wonder why. You know, all you have to do is show this Steph's piece to a lot of school committees, and I think they'd be on board. But I also think there might be pressure, like you said, from parents. No, I want to have my kids to be able to be. So what would the pushback be from the school committees, do you think?
I think, you know, from teachers, you know, teachers' concerns about, you know, that it's a lot to monitor and whatnot. So I think that the balance has to be found. But I do think parents have a legitimate right and a concern that they want to be able to be in touch with their kids, you know, either for pick them up or you know, God forbid something happens
and
in the schools.
I am curious if this was proposed somewhere like Barrington, whether there'd be like more pushback from parents that we didn't necessarily see in Central Falls. But I think there are parents who are texting their kids during the school day about things that are not necessarily urgent.
Right. That's probably true.
You think?
That's probably true.
And so, you know, no, if there is an emergency, of course you can call the school.
Right. Like the old days, right.
And they, you know, and the schools need to make sure that they are staffing those landlines, I should say, and make sure someone's actually picking up the phone in the office.
Right.
Can I just say as an aside, Is there any doubt that that's Viola Davis's sister?
No.
Oh my goodness! Yeah.
I know.
There and her. I mean, the
she
way
she.
I know.
Exactly
I know she's a drama
like
teacher, yeah. But she delivered those lines. I thought she should get an Emmy for being on your.
I told her because she's nearing retirement, and I said, "Well, are you going to go into acting after this?"
I thought it was kind of
really
cool because Viola was there like within the last month. She
yeah,
just kind of slips in now and without a lot of fanfare. And
yeah,
and
she's the local town hero.
Yeah,
great opportunity for those kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty cool. The Washington Bridge. What would a show be without talking about the Washington Bridge? Mike, we had you on, I think, shortly, one of the first shows of the year. You're the solicitor in East Providence. You're in Providence. I know Mayor DeSilva's been kind of under fire out there. Governor McKee talked about a day of reckoning coming. What do you envision as the day of reckoning?
You know, I think the day of reckoning probably is going to be lawsuits, right? I think that's what they probably meant. I don't know if, you know, people are actually going to be fired. A lot of these contractors were hired to inspect it and the construction. There weren't any, people who work for the state who were involved. They're mostly all contractors. But I think that's probably going to be the day of reckoning will be lawsuits and monetary damages. I doubt people are going to be fired over it. I think if they were going to be fired, they would have been fired by now. So that's how I think the day of reckoning is.
The $58 million we spent while...
That's in the river?
To discover... yeah, that's going in the river that the taxpayers spent. And I don't go for the fact, only 20 of it or whatever was state money. We pay federal taxes in Rhode Island, so I consider the whole 58 to be, our problem as taxpayers.
I thought Secretary Buttigieg's response was brilliant. Basically, wasn't this a waste of money? And he said, no, actually, it wasn't, because if we weren't spending or working on this bridge, we would have never discovered the errors that were there. And
had an engineer who could it.
Yeah. And he misspoke about that because he said that the inspections caught the problem, which actually isn't true. The inspection said that the bridge was fine. It was the so-called young engineer who may actually be in his middle-aged, but who discovered the problem during the actual construction work.
It's hard to believe there will be a reckoning within Rhode Island government, seeing as it's all one party so often and one team. I just, we'd be much better off in a situation like this if we had some party diversity in the state, which we really don't have.
But the way it's set up, you have inspectors that are the contract. Ultimately, the answer to DOT. Doesn't the buck stop at DOT, regardless of what's going on in the field? You have to sign off at some point.
Yeah, and my colleague Brian Amaral tried to ask at the news conference, the Day of Reckoning news conference. He said to Director Alviti, when's your Day of Reckoning coming? And he sort of pivoted to, here's all the great things we've done at DOT and we fixed all these bridges. I am curious about whether Director Alviti might retire before this bridge project gets underway because of, his age. I don't want to age him, so I think...
He's early 70s.
I think he's in his early 70s. And if he's not going to stay until the bridge opens in 2026 or beyond, does it make sense to have a new director before the project starts? That's going to be a decision for Director Alviti and Governor McKee to make.
Would you agree with that?
I think so. I think that's probably right.
Now, Steph, during my television days, back in the dark ages, I had a news director who would have given me 2 days off if I got an interview with the young engineer.
I have emailed and called him so many times.
Is this the guy who they named?
It's either him or that's the supervisor of the young engineer.
That's the whole point. They've got a muzzle on the poor guy.
Yeah, I don't know.
And he can't talk. Wouldn't it be great if we could get the information?
Not to go back to the APRA conversation, but so much of state government's work is being done by private contractors, and so it's almost like a loophole where that the contractors are doing, they don't have to talk to me. Their emails aren't public unless they're emailing the DOT.
Maybe the word would be clandestine.
Yeah.
State government. Everything is so quiet and clandestine.
Please call me.
I'd give you 2 days off if you got the thing. Mike, let me just finish with you because you are in East Providence as the solicitor there. I've heard a lot of people saying, in the rush of the news and getting on, and I had a pretty easy commute in today, that a lot of the businesses in East Providence are getting hit. Where is the government here? Where are the chambers of commerce? Where are the hospitality association? Because, we're on to the next thing, but they're trying to run their business.
The restaurants have been hit the hardest. I talked to, there were two forums, one sponsored by the mayor, one by the city council. There have been efforts to try to get some of those chamber of commerces together. Unfortunately, the Small Business Association, federal, they're only given 4% loans.
And
a business, you know, we don't want the loans. We need grants or help and, you know, issues with marketing and whatnot. Yeah. So there has been, I think in the last week or two, a month or two, there has been a re-energization of local groups getting together, working together to try to get some help. But some of the small businesses and restaurants are hurting. I will say, I work in East Providence almost every day. You can get over the bridge. You can you can go after 6 o'clock for dinner.
Well, that's what the mayor has said. Right. Most times it's tenable.
Right.
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 All right. Let's do outrages and or kudos. Nick, let's start with you this week.
Oh, well, kudos. I'd have to say the Attorney General, Peter Nerona, and his staff, Nick Vaz, did a great job in defending the law that is going to save Johnson's Pond. They did a super job. It was decided just earlier this week, and I want to just make sure they get some credit for that.
So let's just set the table.
The Socs were making a mess of the town and of Johnson's Pond.
And people, they wanted to they own it. They wanted to lower the level. The state passed a law that said you can't do that without a permit.
Correct.
And they were challenging that law.
That's correct. Sorry, I didn't give the proper background,
fine.
But that's exactly right.
Okay. Mike, what do you have?
Mine is, I think a company called Optimum Financial has announced that they have purchased or will purchase the two Fall River hospitals, St. Anne's and another. And I'm just a little concerned that a company called Optimum Financial will now be running the two hospitals in Fall River. And I think we might be seeing some of that here in Rhode Island as well. Yeah. Where have we come as a society that we have these financial companies now buying hospitals and running healthcare?
But do you remember years ago, I think when Patrick Kennedy, that's how long it's been. Did you have any overlap with him?
No.
He was way before.
That's probably Nick.
They were, you did have, I think you did
not,
have a little.
Not
Brian
when
Patrick
the house.
Kennedy. Patrick Kennedy, the congressman.
Patrick Kennedy was in Congress when I was House Minority Whip.
Years ago, they wanted to don't have any for-profit hospitals come in. And then the dam opened. And, you know, that was the big thing on charter care coming in. And I think that's where healthcare is going. But I think it's a bad direction. It's almost like newspapers being run by hedge fund managers, right?
Yep.
Yes.
Just Patrick Kennedy did fight that. It's one of the many legacies that he has. And, you know, at the time, I disagreed with him on a lot of things. But looking back, he was right.
I think it was Columbia coming in or somebody,
and they
beat back the challenge. Yeah, that was back in the dark ages, Steph, when I was reporting.
Understood.
So we
stepped on my outrage a little bit in our conversation about the APRA bill, but
okay.
I just have to point out the dramatic irony of all of the state agencies coming out of the woodwork to testify against the bill when many of them have been found to have violated the APRA. And
absolutely,
they even admitted in their testimony that the fees are good because it gets the requester to narrow their request. So are they acknowledging there that they are levying fees specifically to get us to narrow our request and potentially exclude something that might be in the public interest? I continue to think that when something is in the public interest, we are already, taxpayers are paying the people who are fulfilling these public records requests. We should not be double paying for the work it takes to fulfill the APRA.
And you narrowed your request, remember? Yours was pretty wide for the bridge emails,
right? Yes, and they didn't charge me. The governor's office did, but I'm sorry, the DOT did not, but the governor's office did, yes.
Quickly.
Oh, I think they were charging the Providence Journal. I think Kathy Gray put it in her story.
Yeah, different amounts.
Yeah.
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 All right, folks, that is all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us. Mike, good to see you back. Nick and Steph. Folks, come back here next week. We're in the heat of the General Assembly session. We'll have all of the latest news and analysis next week as the Lively Experiment continues. We hope you have a great Easter weekend.
The Lively Experiment is generously underwritten by...
Hi, I'm John Hazen-White, Jr. For over 30 years, a Lively Experiment has provided insight and analysis of the political issues that face Rhode Islanders. I'm a proud supporter of this great program and Rhode Island PBS.